K2 Romeo India Whiskey. It's a guy named Dick, and you're listening to him. K2 KEY Kilo Echo Yankee is a guy named Mel. You'll be hearing from him. And these two characters run a thing called the TechNet, because they think they got the ability to gather these guys, these experts that come from the tri-state area, sometimes a little bit beyond. We gather the clan and we discuss ham radio in a fairly serious manner. We help each other find out how to make the best antenna, the best transmission line, find the best transmitter, the best receiver, the best mode of operation, how to have more fun, how to understand this stuff. And you'd be amazed how much the so-called experts only partially understand what the hell Mother Nature is telling them when that radio wave propagates through some of those really wicked environments. I am still amazed where I used to make trips to Utica, New York, to work at the Romare Development Center every weekend, and I am 200 miles from a guy in southern New Jersey. I'm using single sideband 2 meters from my automobile with a yucky antenna on the car, and I'm talking 200 miles away to a guy with a good moon-bounce antenna aimed at the horizon. And I'm saying to myself, how the hell did that signal sift through 200 miles of hills, trees, buildings, water towers, and whatever? And sometimes I'm on the north side of the Adirondack Mountains, and, on Route 90, how the heck did that signal get there? What kind of a crazy path is it taking? And I was getting 90% copy in the sideman mode while I'm driving along at 60 miles an hour, talking to these guys for hours on end, because it was a 4.5-hour trip. I mean, we can sit here and explain, speculate how the world that signal gets there. And so, one of many subjects. We're probably going to discuss fractals tonight, because there was a nice nova on that subject, and gives you something to look forward to. A person signs into the TechNet because he's got a question or a comment. By good Mel and Dick, your call letters, your name. Oh, by the way, there's also a marathon today. We'll talk about that, too. You give people your call letters, your name, and the confirming yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. A sign-in would sound like this, KE2EJ, Eric, and yes. So do we have any check-ins? Give me your call letters and name at this time. K2OP, repeater.
Timeout.
Repeater.
Timeout.
E2EO, Rich, and yes.
Rich recognized. Anyone else?
WHYY.
Brian.
Joe.
Yes.
K2KYQ. Just listening in.
Okay, KYQ we got. Joe we got. RYY. Who was the person before Joe RYY? I missed that one.
There's a K2EVD. Yes, my name is Brian.
We got you, Brian. So far, Rich, Brian, and Joe are the yeses. KYQ is a no so far. Anyone else to check in? Give me your call letters and name, and that confirming yes if you got a question or a comment. And do so right now.
KC2MDP, Steve, and yes.
N2RSO, Frank, no.
Frank with a no. Anyone else?
And good evening, all. This is K2KEY.
And KEY, what is your handle? That's a joke, Mel. Hang in there. Anyone else?
KC2OES, Fred, and yes.
Fred, we got you. All right, we got more than enough to get started here. Rich, N2EL, what's going on there in Whitestone? And are you keeping jingles happy? N2 Echo Oscar, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, K2RIW, TechNet, Weimark, N2EO. Yeah, Jingles is outside right now. So he'll come in, he'll eat, he'll probably hear the radio and come upstairs. All right, we'll say good evening, Dick. Dick, I've got a design question. I haven't done a lot of work with audio mixers, especially tubes. And, I've got a combination of 4 receivers. Some of them are transceivers, some of them are receivers. And I've got all these speakers. What occurred to me that might be a nice project over the winter, I want to do it with tubes because it's a busy station. The rest of the station is tubes. I wanted to come off the speaker outputs of 4 different receivers, swap the outputs, go into the grids of 1287, which is a full triode. I forget I used 12827. That will give me four inputs, and then from there go into an audio output stage. Either I was thinking either maybe one single engine 6L6. I don't think I need a push-pull 6L6 pair, but maybe that would be desirable. I wonder what you think. And then into one big speaker, one big column speaker. See, I don't want to have a switch. I want to be able to mix these signals simultaneously from various receivers. Let me let it drop.
Let me make a quick break here. Anyone who's signing in to the TechNet tonight, bear in mind, let me drop for a second. Every so often the audio drops down, I don't know why. You have to have a PL tonight, a 136.5 PL, otherwise this repeater will not receive you. And Eric, our chief engineer for the place, said it had to be in that mode tonight because of some of the glitching noises that the thing is picking up. So if you try to sign into the TechNet tonight and you don't have a PL tone, you don't get through, now you know why. I'll proceed, Rich. Go ahead. And by the way, I've got a strong suggestion on the right way to do mixing. And I'm going to make a valiant effort to try to talk you into using something other than that tube you mentioned. Go ahead, Rich.
Okay, Dick. Well, whatever you think. I would like to do it with tubes. I think it would be a fun project if you got some of the tubes in mind. But what I'm wondering is if I use four triodes, can I take the output of the four triodes, put them all together, and then couple to an interstage transformer to the output stage, or do I have to isolate the output of the four channels, so to speak? Also, what would you recommend for swamping the output? I'm going to come off the speaker jack of these radios, so I have to swamp the output. Maybe I think you could probably tell me a 6 or a 10 dB band before I go into the grids of those 12A7. Back to you, Dick. K2RIW, TechNet Limelock, M2EO.
Okay, now just to make sure I don't go way off on a tangent here, Rich, you've got four sources of audio, I'm going to say, coming out of four separate receivers. You want to be able to hear the audio out of all of them simultaneously. You want them to be summed together in a thoroughly linear manner. That is to say, the audio out of one doesn't create distortion out of the other. So, in other words, as if you had four separate loudspeakers all in one cabinet, but you want one chunk of electronics to do all this. And you probably would like to have various volume controls. In other words, either on the radio itself or on this piece of summing audio electronics, you'd like to be able to turn up the gain on channel number 3 while turning down the gain on channel number 2 and have the other channels not be affected in any way. In other words, thoroughly linear mixing with no intermixing, no cross-modulation, no cross-gain controls and whatever. Am I getting close to what you're looking for? Because, boy, do I have a suggestion for you. So before I go way off on this one, Rich, tell me if I'm close to what you're looking for. K2LIW.
You're not only close, you're right on the button, Dick. And yeah, that was my other question. If I mix them, there might be intermodulation between the channels. So you go ahead. You're way ahead of me. K2RIW, TechNet Limelock, and TechNetLimelock. I'm all ears.
Okay, I have done that on multiple occasions. I've mixed together signals as high as a megacycle with audio. I've mixed sawtooth, square wave, sine wave, CW. In other words, I can give you a circuit that'll take whatever is in the four channels, everything from DC, and I really mean DC. In other words, one of those channels could be putting out a steady state half volt signal, and I want that to be mixed into the output. All of that can take place with AC coupling or DC coupling, your choice, with essentially no drift. The device that will do that for you will cost you 50 cents in a bubble pack at Radio Shack. It will be the equivalent of four perfect 12AU7 tubes, perfectly used, lasting forever, no mixing between them. I know this sounds too good to be true. It's unfortunately that you're going to have to jump into a slightly different technology than you're familiar with. The Radio Amateur's Handbook will give you some information on this. I can suggest 5 real good textbooks that will help you on this. But even before we do that, I can draw the schematic here mentally for you, and I'm talking about a single solid-state operational amplifier. If you haven't ever used one of these things at audio, a good quality 50-cent operational amplifier that'll run anything from plus and minus 1 volt all the way up to plus 4 volts only, all the way up to plus and minus 15 volts. I mean, these op amps are amazingly forgiving. Some of them have got mega ohms of input impedance, output impedance of 1 ohm, and I'm not kidding, it'll drive anything up to its limit of milliamperes or up to its limit of peak-to-peak voltage that you give it. But other than that, the thing has got 100 decibels of gain and more inside, and you can make the gain of each one of those channels thoroughly independent, absolutely not mixed to each other. I'm talking about an inverting-type summing op-amp circuit. Once you've used one of these things, it's so inexpensive to buy it, with your vector board and a couple of resistors and some clip leads and whatever on your bench, you can try the thing out first. Prove
repeater, timeout, cancel.
You'll prove to yourself you like the performance. After that, you'll build a beautiful box around it, and you'll make a couple more of them because you'll say, wow, the world has opened up to me. Let me give you a couple of hints now as to how an op-amp works. And you probably know, but part of what I'm saying is for the benefit of other people. If I've got an op-amp with 120 decibels of gain, which is a typical old-fashioned 741 op-amp, I'm talking about 1970 technology, and of course it's a much more modern one, but you take a 741, 120 decibels of gain, up to 10 hertz, and then it rolls off a little bit. When you got 120 dB of gain, you can roll off for a long way before you know about that gain. What is 120 decibels of gain? It's a volt per microvolt. In other words, across the two input terminals, there's a plus and a minus terminal that act like they are the upper and lower lead of a primary of a transformer, so to speak. But it's a DC transformer. You put 1 microvolt between the plus and the minus lead, in theory, and out comes 1 volt of difference. That's a lot of gain in one tiny little chip. There's about 30 transistors, a bunch of resistors, and everything else in there. You're getting a lot of your money out of that 50 cents to buy the thing. And maybe if you buy the super duper one nowadays, maybe you'll spend a dollar for a man your resources. The price of the parts are not what we're talking about. The quality of what you're going to get out of this thing is just going to blow your mind. You won't want to use a tube again for something like this that you build with your own hands. Now, you're going to use those 12 AU7 tubes to substitute what's in your, a particular IF stage of your Collins rig because you want to keep its tradition, and that I understand. But when it comes to summing them, this thing does such a perfect job, and let me show you why. If I, in simplistic language now, I'm cutting a couple of corners, making things a little bit simple. If the positive lead of the op-amp is grounded, and if I take the negative lead and put a 1K resistor between it and the output of the op-amp, so right now I've got negative feedback, 1K resistor. For every milliamp of current I pour into that negative lead, the one that's got the 1K resistor also there, going to the output, so there's a junction there, and I'm going to make a junction of I'm going to make a junction of 4 resistors plus the 1K resistor that's the feedback, all going to the negative lead. For every 1 milliamp of current I pour into that negative junction, negative lead junction, 1 volt of output will come out of the op-amp. When you study the voltage that's on that negative lead, it will never move more than approximately 1 microvolt because the feedback is going to correct for that. In other words, if you put 1 microvolt of current into, if you put 1 microvolt of voltage on that negative lead, the output will go minus 1 volt the 1K resistor will feed the minus 1 volt back and cancel your 1 milliamp and bring it right back to normal again. In other words, when you set it up with the positive lead grounded and the negative lead has got a 1K resistor being fed back, the input looks like the world's best short circuit. The op-amp itself may have an input impedance of 1 megohm, but because of the way the feedback works, it's called a virtual ground. No voltage appears there. You put your highest gain scope while the thing is operating, and most likely you don't see the voltage on that negative junction lead. But every one of your resistors that's summing audio in there, if a milliamp of current flows on any one of those resistors, it creates 1 volt of output in this example I'm describing to you. So now, if all of my four sources, my four radios, have their audio coming through a 1K resistor before they go to that junction, so I got four 1K resistors going to the four audio sources, and I've got a fifth 1K resistor, which is that feedback resistor, so I got five resistors all coming together at that junction on the negative lead of the op-amp. As each one of those audio circuits, as each one of those audio circuits produces its voltage on its 1K series resistor, and it goes into that junction, and because the junction always acts like a dead short to ground, you never have more than a microvolt across it. That property of the op-amp makes zero mixing between those signals. Those four signals, or 14 signals going in there, are thoroughly independent from each other. They're all going into a short circuit. They have no ability of the audio of radio number one going through its network coming out and disturbing the audio of radio number two. Every one of those radios, the audio output, has got its own 1K resistor that looks like it's going to ground. It happens to be an electronic ground, electronic short circuit, but it'll give you the most beautiful mixing of those signals, the most high linearity you could ever imagine. We're talking about 0.01% harmonic distortion here. Choose the right op-amp, you won't be able to hear the noise it makes, it'll be quiet as all hell, and it mixes your signals together. And you can adjust those 1K resistors going to each one of those radios, or adjust the audio output of each one of the radios if you like. But once you build one of these circuits, once you see how an op-amp works, and this is the most basic way of using an op-amp, an inverting summing amplifier is what you're building. You will never go back to a tube again and all the rigmarole of building a, you know, drilling a hole in the chassis for the darn tube socket, supplying the high voltage, the screen voltage, the grid bias, the cathode bias, the bypass capacitor, all of that jazz. None of that's required with this op-amp. I know you may feel a little bit uncomfortable if you guys haven't yet used an op-amp in this manner. And if I direct you to the right book which explains to you how to do it, and I've given you a quick thumbnail sketch here of the thing, it's the best thing since baked bread, Rich. Hot baked brand new bread out of your favorite bakery that sells you your bagels in the morning. You're probably going to have a few more questions, but I think you see where I'm going here. Anything since 1990, let's say, or 1980, when you're doing a circuit like you described, if you're doing it without an op-amp, your circuit is obsolete even before you draw the schematic diagram on a piece of paper. That's a strongly felt opinion. N2 Echo Oscar, the support question. K2LIW on the deck net.
Yeah, K2KEY with a comment on it.
Stand by, Rich. Let's hear. Mel, I'll bet you've used op-amps on a circuit somewhat like that, and I bet you said, wow. Over to you, Mel.
Oh, yes, I'm surely I had a lot of experience with op-amplifiers, but what Rich wants to do, a few years back when I was doing experiments with several receivers on different antennas on the same band, I wanted to put the audio basically together in a situation that I could easily turn up one, turn down the other, you know, and still come out of the same source. And I found a unit, just what you described, based on basically the principle that you just described, but in a commercial version called the Shure 267 Mixer. The beautiful part about it is not only it has controls of each input, but also it has things like high cut, low cut, and limiting that you can adjust for each channel, and in other words, tailor it. You want to tailor the audio for each channel, and then either produce it, of course, simultaneously, or individually into one output system, in one amplifier. Has meter on it and everything. Beautiful unit based on basically up amplifiers, but a little bit more sophisticated, Dick. This is KTKY back to you.
Okay, boy, he hit the next one nail on the head. Not only can you get perfect linearity, perfect non-coupling between the four audio signals, complete independent gain control of those signals, no intermodulation distortion, no mixing, ideal summing of individual signals where each signal goes through like it's the only one that was ever there. So there happens to be four of them there, or 14 of them there, that's you. That's up to you. By adding a couple of resistors and a potentiometer and a couple of capacitors, two capacitors, a couple of resistors and two potentiometers in the feedback network of that single op amp, or with a cascaded op amp, one more down range if you want to, you can easily build yourself what's called a Baxandl circuit. You look up on the website, Baxandl, B-A-X-A-N-D-A-L, I may be spelling it wrong, but Baxandl circuit, that is the treble, boost, bass, you know, the treble and bass boost and cut. You just simply operate one control and the boost goes 20 dB up or 20 dB down, or anything in between. You operate the other potentiometer and the treble, the high frequencies go 20 dB up or 20 dB down, or make it flat. An equalizer circuit, a Baxandl circuit with an op amp, the easiest thing in the world, very few components. Now you can control the tone in a thoroughly linear manner. I've been very tempted to some time now to build a Baxandl circuit to slightly boost up the high frequency notes coming out of the microphone you're listening to right now. Because I know that some of the high frequency notes are not coming out of my rig properly into the repeater, and therefore you guys are not hearing full fidelity of RIW and KEY. So we have to add a Baxandl circuit. I know of a guy who was doing that recently, and boy, does he sound good. It's something I want to do. So you're going to have a bunch of questions here, Rich, but if you get a couple of good books on op amps, if you simply Google operational amplifier summing circuit, operational amplifier audio summing circuit, you Google a couple of those word combinations, you're only going to get 50,000 hits. And the first five of those websites you open up with the diagrams and the explanation of how to do it and a schematic of the exact part numbers, and you look at it and you say, hey, that's $4 worth of parts all running on a flashlight battery or a pen light battery, and it does everything I want. And it's
repeater, timeout, cancel.
And it draws so little current that it'll run on my penlight battery for the next week and a half if I don't even turn it off. When you see that kind of efficiency and quality and inexpensiveness and ease of operation, you're going to say, wow, I've arrived in the 21st century. M2EO, K2RIW.
Okay, Dick, K2RIW, M2EO. Yeah, I'm not that familiar with that, but it's very interesting. I'll probably do it that way. Let me ask you this. The output of the summing op amp, would I want to drive that into like an LM386, I think it's a chip number, an audio chip? It's not going to drive the speaker directly. Well, probably not very loud. And do I need any impedance matching between the 1K? You say couple right out of the 8-ohm speakers to a 1K? Big bang right into the op amp?
There's a yes and a no to that, Rich. Some final audio stages of some rigs that are made for tubes, and maybe Collins falls into this category, where there's a real audio output transformer, which has a primary impedance of a couple thousand ohms going to the audio output tube, a secondary impedance winding of 8 ohms that normally goes to a loudspeaker. If you thoroughly open circuit that audio output transformer inside of the Collins receiver, you may get a little bit of distortion. That circuit was made to operate into 8 ohms. If you want the highest possible fidelity, you place an 8 ohm resistor across that secondary winding of that transformer. Now he thinks he's looking into the world's most beautiful 8 ohm loudspeaker because you put an 8 ohm resistor there. But from that 8 ohm resistor, where one side is grounded and the other side is not, from there you put the 1K resistor into a shielded I said coaxial cable, a shielded piece of a wire, so you don't get any hum pickup, and it goes over to your audio summing circuit. So now you've met all the criteria. The radio is happy. He's seeing 8 ohms in parallel with a 1K resistor, which means 7.999 ohms. He doesn't care. And anything from 2 ohms to 20 ohms will make that transformer happy. But it should have some kind of a load if you want... full fidelity out of the audio output stage of that particular of your radio itself. Then the 1K resistor goes over to the op-amp summing circuit. The output of the op-amp summing circuit has a limitation. If you only fed it from a 1.5 volt battery, obviously it cannot exceed more than 1.5 volts peak to peak before it starts clipping. Whatever voltage you supply to the op-amp, it ain't going to give you a bigger voltage than that. And every op-amp has got a current maximum rating. In the case of that 741 op-amp I told you about, 1975 technology, that thing can only supply 10 milliamps of current, plus or minus 10 milliamps of current, and then it's laptops in current output. That in turn is going to go into some kind of an audio driving circuit. LM386 is probably not a bad choice, because when it is fed properly, it'll take the audio into it and drive a loudspeaker directly. So you're going to have a two-stage thing here. The first op-amp is doing all the summing and or treble and boost of bass, treble and bass boost and cut, if you want to add that to it, but maybe you don't need it at first. And then the second stage will be the real audio driver stage, a power audio stage. And there's a zillion of them in the Radio Shack and in catalogs and whatever. But you can buy a nice little package, a solid-state package, that'll produce 150 watts of audio if that's what you want when you give it enough voltage. And it probably only needs as much audio input as your first op-amp summing network can supply to it. So I think you see the process here. But by doing it with solid-state instead of without tubes, you're going to be way ahead of the game, and I can't think of a way of doing it better. And I bet you if we talked to Eric, and if he really dug inside of his audio summing circuits in his broadcast studios, I'll bet you they're doing something very similar to this. In fact, I'm going to give a little bit of a delay in case Eric wants to give us a couple of words on this. KE2EJ, if you happen to be there. KE2LIW on the TechNet. Okay. Eric is off. Is off tuning up his great big transmitters at his location. So I know that you're going to have a couple more questions over the next week or two as you do research into this one. If this is the first time you've used op-amps, I know you're going to feel a little bit uncomfortable. But because it's 50 cents worth of electronics in the bubble packs at Radio Shack, because replacing it is easy as all hell, unless you do something really gross, they're pretty well self-protected. You can put all kinds of voltages on all the input and output leads of modern-day op-amp, and most of the time it'll survive. So they're quite forgiving, extremely efficient, extremely high in performance in an application like this. And so even if it doesn't work perfectly at first, and you come back to us in future weeks saying that it did this, and that part's okay, but it did that, and that part's not okay, what do I do now? There's only going to be 10 people on this net that's going to tell you what's the next step, Rich. So I think it's time you start walking down this road, because there's an awful lot of gold at the end of this particular rainbow. N2EO, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, K2RIW, TechNet Limelock, N2EO. No, I agree with you, Dick. It sounds like a good way to go. I've used op-amps kits and things. I've never actually designed anything with them. Am I going to need... What do these op-amps require, plus and minus voltages? Am I going to need plus and minus voltages, which is not a problem?
John, good question. If you want the simplest circuit, the easiest to understand, you'll fire up the op-amp with a plus supply and a minus supply. And it can be anything from plus or minus 1.5 volts to plus or minus 15 volts and beyond, depending on which op-amp you're using. You could... Because you don't need a hell of a lot of audio voltage in what you're doing, you could fire the circuit up with a pair of penlight cells, where the junction between the two in series is grounded, and one's giving you plus 1.5 volts, and one's giving you minus 1.5 volts, just to experiment with us on the bench on your vector board to prove to yourself you're so happy with the way it works. You can very easily do it with that. The next level of sophistication of these op-amps is there's a way you can readjust the resistors such that a single power supply does everything. A single plus 5 or plus 10 or plus 12 volts will fire the whole thing. What you do in that particular case is you, the positive lead going into the op-amp, you don't bring it to ground, you bring it to a pair of voltage divider resistors that are halfway between the plus 15 and ground, plus 7.5 volts, so to speak. The slight disadvantage of that is that now all your inputs will have to be AC coupled, because your input will now be, so that negative lead of the op-amp will be sitting at plus 7.5 volts. Whatever voltage you put on the positive lead of the op-amp is only happy if the exact same voltage appears on the negative lead with that feedback resistor. That's the only way you'll be happy. So therefore, your input network will be floating 7.5 volts above ground, and with AC coupling, that's no problem. No problem. But you have the option of making this all DC coupled and nice and simple if you want to use two separate supplies, a plus and a minus. You have that choice. Back to you, Rich.
Okay, Dick, sounds good. I got a few things I want to clean up downstairs, and then I'm going to start breadboarding this. I'll report back to the vet, let you know how it works out. By the way, just another point of interest, you should Radio Shack call. A lot of people go into Radio Shack, they ask for something like, oh, I don't know, let's give an example, 741 op-amp, and the guy will say, no, we don't have that. These people are not well trained, they don't know parts, and they don't make a lot of commission on parts. So there's no real reason for them to look for your part. What I found worked very well, I usually get what I need in there. I go to RadioShack.com, look up the part, and there's an option, find it in a store near you. I plug in my zip code, and I make a printout of what stores has it in stock. It's got a picture at the top of the part with the part number. I go in, I lay the paper on the counter, I say, give me one of these. That always works. Again, the K2RIW Technet Limark and 2EO.
That's the right way to do it, Rich. Now, the one place where I probably led you astray is because if you look into the schematic diagram of the Airborne Instruments Laboratory 707, 727, 737, and 747, those are the model numbers, of the AIL Spectrum Analyzer. A guy named K2RIW had a lot to do with the sweep circuit design, the circuit design that gives us the frequency readout, digital display. In other words, there's a zillion 741 op-amps in there. That design was done in 1969 and 1970, partially by RIW. So I'm very familiar with that op-amp. It was the Cat's Meow op-amp in 1970. Old, old-fashioned design. I just gave this to you as an example because I'm so familiar with the thing. It is so ancient, it probably can't even be bought. You just look up an operational amplifier in the Radio Shack catalog. Guaranteed they got a zillion of them. And you can choose the ones that have FET input or bipolar input or a rail-to-rail type. Rail-to-rail type means that you give it plus 1.5 volts and minus 1.5 volts into its power supply lead, and out of its output lead, it'll give you within a few millivolts as high as plus 1.5 and minus 1.5 volts. That's what they mean by rail-to-rail. It will tolerate input voltages on its plus and minus input lead, and it will give deliver to you output voltages on its output lead that come extremely close to your power supply. And if you study internally how the hell they did that, there's a lot of magic going on there. I mean, with an ordinary tube circuit, you give it a 300-volt supply, and you're lucky to get 150 volts of swing out of that plate with any kind of reasonable linearity. In the case of an op-amp, you give it 3 volts of total supply, and you will get 2.99 volts of peak-to-peak output out of the darn thing. Extremely efficient. So, you just look up the word op-amp, choose the op-amp that has the price, the size, the voltage requirements, the rail-to-rail, the input impedance, the output impedance, whatever you want. And they're so darn inexpensive. Buy two or three different models. Buy a socket to plug them into. Buy some vector board to lay it out the first time. Or do it dead bug style. That's your choice. But the things are so forgiving.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
The things are so forgiving, they can't go wrong. And so choosing one, you're going to have darn many choices. The problem is going to be, gee, there's five of them that fit my requirement. How do I know which one to buy? It doesn't matter. I mean, if you're a guy that's never dated a girl, whether you date a blonde, a brunette, or a redhead, almost doesn't matter. There's some other variables involved here. So not to worry about that. If you ask the Radio Shack online catalog for a 741 equivalent, they probably don't have one that's that bad, so therefore they won't say they've got an equivalent. By that bad, I mean that particular op-amp had a lot of gain. By modern-day standards, it doesn't have rail-to-rail capability. It doesn't go as high in frequency as you might like. It's got a little bit more noise than the modern ones. But you're not looking for nanovolts of noise here. That doesn't matter. You've got great big signals of audio coming out of your four receivers. So choosing the op-amp will be easy. I only use 741 as an example. I don't recommend you go look for 741 equivalent. It's too ancient. I think you see where I'm going here. Any last questions on this, Rich? Go ahead.
Got one more comment that helps him out.
Go ahead, Mel. Give him the comment.
Hey, if you want to really learn how to work with op-amp and do some very interesting experiments, pick out the one you want. There's a book. I don't know. I don't remember where I got it. I think it was at the Radio Shack called Op-Amp Cookbook, Dick, over.
Is that the one by Carl Jung? A very good book. Is that the one you're recommending? Go ahead.
Yeah, I believe so. Yeah, that I think is the one. I can remember. It's not an 8x10 book. It's like one of all type books that they used to handle at Radio Shack. I don't know if they still handle it, but it was called the Op-Amp Cookbook. And terrific. And had a lot of different op-amps in there and applications and specifications. So that's the way to go with op-amps. In fact, I've got that book here somewhere, and I haven't looked at it in a while, but I can picture it, Dick, over.
Just to let you know, Rich, how much in love Mel and Dick are with op-amps. My bookshelf probably contains 35 books on the subject of antennas, probably contains 12 books on the subject of op-amps. With op-amps, you can synthesize active filter networks as if you were doing digital signal processing. You can do it all in analog if you want to. So this guy, Carl Jung, J-U-N-G, wrote this beautiful paperback book, except the darn thing is about 2.5 inches thick, which has got so darn many op-amp circuits in there, it'll snow you. It's got so darn many sections of transconductance amplifier op-amp circuits and the frequency compensating op-amp circuits and whatever. It's got so darn many, it'll snow you. You're looking for something pretty simple. You're going to get the information you want by doing a Google search. You're going to find 50,000 hits, and choosing the right one is going to be a fascinating project because you've got too many ways to go. You've got too many op-amps to choose from. It's going to confuse you. Your circuit requirement is so simple, it is going to be hard for you to choose a 2008 available op-amp that's not going to do what you want. It's going to be hard for you to choose a bad one, if you know what I mean. About the worst you can do is choose one that goes to 1,000 megacycles when you only want to go to a couple of kilohertz. And if you don't lay it out real carefully, you can develop an RF oscillator instead of an op-amp circuit. So don't go for too much quality, if you know what I mean. Let us know how it goes, Rich. You're about to have a brand new world opened up to you. And most of the ham radio classes, most of the ham radio available information in Radio Amateur's Handbook, from my point of view, has not given enough emphasis to the power and capability of those darn little circuits. They are so close to ideal that once you dig into them just for 1 week, you're going to say, why in the world have I waited so long to get on this particular bandwagon? the guys who do real circuit design, anywhere from audio to 1,000 megacycles. If you're doing a real circuit design in this year, and if you're not using op-amps in 5 different places in your circuit, most likely your analog circuit is...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
If you're not using op-amps in 5 different places in your analog circuit, most likely your circuit is obsolete even before you draw the schematic diagram. Now, when it comes to digital circuits, that's another whole bag of worms, or I'm not going to go there right now. But when it comes to op-amps, you got to get on that bandwagon there, Rich. And once you do, you're definitely in the 21st century, and a brand new world can open up to you. Brian's the next guy. He's got a question. K2 Echo Uniform Delta, if I got it correctly, Brian. Go right ahead. Sorry to keep you waiting, sir. K2 RAW, my name is Dick. Okay, maybe Brian got called away. Joe, you own the floor. W-H-U-R-Y-Y? What's the latest in your neighborhood?
Roy White here. Okay, I have a simple question. This should take more than a couple minutes to answer it. If you needed to use a non-polarizing capacitor, and you didn't have one, and you just had regular electrolytics, how would you make those work to make it make them be a non-polarized capacitor type of thing?
Okay, I understand what you're saying. You want a non-polarized capacitor. In other words, you're putting it into a circuit where the actual voltage across the capacitor could be positive or negative. And most of the small capacitors of the, approximately 1 microfarad and above, are highly polarized, tantalum and whatever, highly polarized. And when you want a one microfarad capacitor that's thoroughly non-polarized, you can buy it, but they're probably 4 times higher in price. What I have done on a number of occasions is to take a pair of polarized capacitors and put them back to back. But there's a catch. What you're really doing when you put a pair of polarized capacitors back to back is you're depending on the fact that when you put a positive voltage across the pair, one of them is being forward biased, positive on its positive lead, that's good. Negative voltage is appearing on the positive lead of the other one, and you're waiting for the conductivity of the capacitor with reverse polarity to make everything come out right. That's not so ideal. Now, people have done it and they've gotten away with it. I'll give you an example of where I really needed to do this. In the case of the 120 microfarad electrolytic capacitor that runs my Cornell Dubler Ham-M rotator, 120 microfarad non-polarized AC capacitor, I didn't have one of those, and mine had gone dry, going down to only a couple of microfarads. I had zero torque out of the rotator, and it wasn't turning. I knew that if I put a pair of 240 microfarad capacitors in series, back-to-back, I'd have an AC capacitor. But because I'm putting real AC voltage on it from the transformer continuously, and one of those capacitors is going to be back-biased and conducting current and damaging itself, what I did was put a pair of diodes across each capacitor. So I put the two capacitors, 240 volts, a pair of them in series, by the series combining network, made 120 microfarads equivalent, and to force the AC voltage on them to be the right polarity, I put a diode across each capacitor, with the cathode of the diode going to the positive lead, in both cases. Now as you apply the AC voltage, during the first half cycle, well, the first full cycle, one half cycle starts charging up one capacitor, the other half cycle charges up the other capacitor, and if there was 30 volts of peak voltage AC coming out of my transformer, out of the control box for the Ham-M, after the full first cycle, there would be positive 30 volts on one capacitor, positive 30 volts with the right polarity on the other capacitor, the two of them back-to-back would be...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
The two of them back-to-back means that there was 0 volts across the combination of the series capacitors. After the first cycle, when the diodes charged up the capacitors, from then on, no mysterious currents were being drawn. The first one or two cycles are a little bit strange, and the rotator doesn't move. But that goes by in 32 milliseconds. You never know the difference. then the capacitors are fully charged. After that, if I had that network of two diodes and the two back-to-back 240 microfarad capacitors in one black box, and in the other black box I had a real 120 microfarad AC electrolytic capacitor from the outside world of the two black boxes, after the first cycle, you couldn't tell which one was which. Electronically, it's nearly perfect. So that's one way you can do it on the safer side to make sure you're really not back-biasing one of the capacitors and therefore damaging it. You take a tantalum capacitor, and if for any period of time you put a reverse polarity on it, you're doing a kind of depolarization of the chemistry that's inside, and what has happened on many printed circuits with these modern-day surface-mount capacitors, if the department that assembled the thing for you put some of those tantalum capacitors, surface mount, into the printed circuit board backwards, and you fire it up on the bench, either now or a few hours downrange, a couple of those tantalum capacitors will explode. You take a tantalum capacitor and you put reverse polarity on it of the right voltage for a long enough period of time, there's a chance it'll leave a black mark on your printed circuit board where that component used to be. WAQLYY, KQLIW on the tech net.
Okay, you said when you put the tabs back to back, you mean the negative leads towards each other and the plus going out?
That's one way of doing it. By the way, Joe, by whatever channel you're going into, you're reasonably noisy. You're not getting quite enough RF or audio to that particular channel. Yes. If I took the two capacitors and put them in series with the negative leads touching each other, and now the two positive leads are my connection to the rest of the circuit, and if you put a diode across each capacitor, such that the cathode of the diode goes to the positive lead of that capacitor, and you do that on each capacitor, you're now double darn sure, just that the two capacitors you put in series should be twice the number of microfarads you're looking for, because there's really two capacitors in series. At first you're going to say, gee, the diode is shorting out one capacitor in one half cycle, and the other way on the other half cycle, and therefore I could use the normal value capacitors instead of doubling those capacitor values. Don't fall into that trap. After the first cycle when the diodes charge the capacitors, from then on the diodes are no longer in the circuit, and therefore you've got two capacitors in series. If you want 100 microfarads equivalent, put a pair of 200 microfarads in series. The B2LYY, B2LIW.
That noise is not coming from me.
I accept that, but I can hear you. Go ahead and talk, Joe.
Okay, the reason I asked this question is because I had two extra class licensees tell me that you make a non-polarized capacitor circuit by taking four electrolytics and putting plus to minus to plus to protect the circuit.
And put them in parallel? Absolutely, positively wrong. Dead wrong. And you do that with a power circuit like a ham a control box, and there's a moderately good chance you're going to have smoke and flames. Absolutely not. It's obvious that when you put the two in parallel like that, on one half cycle, one capacitor is unhappy, and the other half cycle, the other's unhappy. You've now got to... You don't have a win-win. You got to lose-lose. You don't want to do that. You've got to put them in series, negative to negative. And if you want, you can put them positive to positive. It doesn't matter. But you're going to put them in series so that they are back-to-back polarity-wise. And if you want to really be double-darn sure, you're going to put diodes across them to make sure that reverse polarity of either capacitor is impossible. Modern-day tantalum polarized capacitors, you want to make sure you never get a reverse voltage across them. Otherwise, you are doing damage. And if you do it for a long enough period of time, you will get smoke and flame. Over to you, Rich. Here we go. Joe.
Plus to plus or minus to minus in series.
You can't put plus to plus and minus to minus in series. If you're putting two capacitors in series, you're either going to put the two negative leads together, that's one choice, or you're going to put the two positive leads together. You're going to set them up so that in series they are polarity-wise back to back. The way you worded it at first, plus to plus, minus to minus, sounds like you're putting them in parallel with one up and the other one down. I know you're going to put them in series, and whichever way you choose, the pair of negatives together, that's one choice, or the pair of positives together in series. With diodes, it will fly. Have at it. Back to you, Joe.
Yes, I probably did word that wrong. Okay, now I understand. So there's no damage done either way if you put them plus to plus and minus to minus as far as the pair of chances in series are concerned. I didn't think about the diodes as far as adding that to service, but I basically told these people that you don't put things in parallel for the series.
Yeah, your simplistic wording of plus to plus, minus to minus. Oh, no, you said plus to minus and minus to plus. Your words indicated parallel connection. They're going to be series connection, and when you look at the series connection as a schematic diagram, one capacitor will look like it's right side up, and the other one looks like it's upside down, but they're in series. So try it, you'll like it. Okay, the next person who signed in with a real question was Steve, KC2MDP. What's going on with your neighborhood, Steve? K2LIW.
Good evening, Dick. Good evening to everyone else out on net. Dick, basically, I got a simple question tonight. I have a couple of, the Motorola HD commercial radios. Basically, you got the, screw-in antenna. How would I go about connecting that to, let's say, an external antenna or a brick amplifier for that matter? Basically, it's just a single stud that goes into the HD itself, the antenna. Back to you.
It's worldwide.
Go ahead, Joe.
Motorola uses that type of antenna for a couple of years, many years. You have to look and see very carefully if the antenna itself is just being conducted in that stud, or if there actually is a hole in the center of the stud for the jack. What model radio do you use?
I got the Saber. I know the one you mean. The Astro's got the little pin inside. The ones I have are basically the Saber. I have an MTX. I have a GTX, which is all the solid stud. Back to you.
Saber. There's a the RF is connected onto the back of the radio. And I believe the cable is an NTN 5570 cable assembly that will attach the back of the radio and come out to a BNC female type of connector. That's how you get the RF out of its saber. The other two radios I'm not specifically sure of.
Yeah, I'm looking at a XTX radio right now. I've unplugged the antenna. And what you look into has the approximate size of an SMA, except that it's a kind of a reverse polarity SMA. No, it isn't. It's a kind of reverse polarity. Somewhere on the planet, there is an adapter you can get your hands on, where one end of the adapter will plug directly into the Motorola radio, and the other end comes out with something you like BNC, SMA, MMCX, UHF, N, or whatever. Somebody makes an adapter. Once you plug that adapter into the radio, so that now it adapts you to a 50-ohm output connector, and with your cable connected to that 50-ohm output connector, you connect it to your antenna. After that, you're in like Flynn. But there's a catch. And the catch is that almost all handy-talky radios, almost all handy-talky radios, and by the way, I don't think we have to wait for the beep. As long as we drop the carrier, I believe it resets the timer when you're using TO input like we are right now. We'll soon find out. If I time out, you'll know. Okay. Because to wait for that Don drop with all of that glitchy noises we got in there, it's going to really slow things down. So let's try it without that until we get away with it. And so once you've got the proper adapter and you go into your coaxial cable that goes to your rooftop antenna, The good news is your handy talkie is going to have a lot more range. The bad news is you're going to find out that almost every handy talkie will have intermodulation distortion up the kazoo if you're in a major metro area where there's a lot of local transmitters. Your handy talkie, you know it doesn't have a great big filter in the front end because there ain't enough room inside that box. Also, the main thing you and I care about with a handy talkie is we like it to run on a battery in the receive mode standby for 20 hours, 24 hours, 2 days. In other words, they set the radio up so it draws very little current in the receive mode. That means none of the stages are biased high in current. That means none of the stages are biased high in current. Therefore, none of the stages have high dynamic range. You can really rapidly see what happens. If you just take your handy talkie with its rubber duck and you go to the observation deck of the Empire State Building, the darn thing will jump out of your hand and there'll be so many signals roaring through that loudspeaker, you won't be able to hear your favorite repeater that's on the air. The thing is being overloaded because it doesn't have much front-end filtering, doesn't have much dynamic range. It's made to work on a very simple rubber duck antenna. And you put a really robust antenna from the top of your tower into the handy-talkie, you're going to get some funny responses. And when you compare the reception capability in a busy requirement, and you compare the difference between a tabletop or a mobile radio compared to a handy-talkie, you're going to be disappointed. If you don't believe that, Owen Garriott, in 1985, on Space Shuttle number 6 or whatever it was, I supposedly was one of the guys that talked to him, you buy the tape where you listen to what he heard from space. He had a simple Motorola handy-talkie, a quality one, with a simple antenna taped to the window of the space shuttle. He's 150 nautical miles above the center of the United States. He's looking at a 1,500-mile diameter of humanity all at once with all of those signals. And you listen to that tape recording of what he heard from space. He was able to hear the ham radio operators who were running 1,000 watts into a moon-bounce antenna aimed at the space shuttle. No problem. And he, running 1.5 or 3 or 5 watts coming back down, line of sight, you could hear him from 1,000 miles away. No sweat. Therefore, you running 5 watts transmitting back to him, you think by reciprocity you're going to get to him. Well, with all of the humanity shouting at him at once, plus all of those other transmitters on adjacent frequencies, that poor radio was really overloaded like crazy. So you're going to see some funny overload characteristics when you connect a handy-talkie to a good rooftop antenna in a metro environment. In a rural environment, you'll be happy as all heck. But in a metro environment with a lot of transmitters, and now you understand what the real dynamic range of a handy-talkie receiver is and the real filtering characteristics of its front end, be wary, you're going to hear some funny things.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Back to you, Steve. KC2MDP, K2LAW.
Okay, Dick, yeah, very good. Yeah, basically I wanted to set up, I picked up this HT for, it's got digital, and I just wanted to, play with the HT. There's a couple of repeaters supposedly in Jersey, and I wanted to hook an amp to it. So I will definitely be aware of that. I appreciate all the info from you and from the other guy. I will see if I can find one of those adapter cables and at least play with the digital one. Back to you, Dick, and once again, thank you very much.
Hey, it's Roy. I want to comment on that. Joe recognize you can get around this problem by getting your hands on a good cavity filter that's narrowband, lightly loaded, and put it between the handy talkie, a piece of coax cable into the filter and the output of the filter into your rooftop antenna. You put a good filter on the front end so it's looking at only 146 to 147 megacycles inclusive, or maybe even more narrow than that, and an awful lot of this overload characteristic I'm talking about will go away. So by you adding the external filter that Motorola did not have the real estate to do inside the handy talkie, you add that filter externally, and you can make the thing work very nicely. Go ahead, Joe. W2LYY, K2LAW.
Yeah, there's a website called BatLabs, BatLabs.com. It's got a wealth of information available on it. All the different various Motorola products, portables, base stations, and mobile radios. And if you find the particular model you're looking for, look it up. Go down to the page that has the information on it. Probably find all you're looking for as far as programming software required to program the radio, antenna adapter, if it's